Good morning.
Aloha.
What a delightful beginning of a conference. And I just need to check, is it 9:35 or 9:40? So I have about 45 minutes to talk? No, I'm just teasing. It's a pleasure to be here. Got here a day and a half ago and went to the training session yesterday. I was so impressed by the caliber, not only of Tim's presentation, but the questions and interactions. It's a very impressive organization. I'm humbled and honored to be part of it. I'm a professor, so I tend to talk more theoretically and philosophically sometimes, so let me apologize up front. Sustainability, as the dean mentioned earlier, is very important, and Mr. Hashimoto mentioned that as well. I've been the director of the Center for Sustainable Development, and you all know about the three E's, the ecology and equity and economics. And those factors, if all are solved together, can provide for a sustainable way of living. In Austin, I have learned, just by being involved in the practice of planning, that the most sustainable thing one can do is to reuse an old building, to reuse something, as opposed to build something new every time, even though it may be very efficient and ecological and equitable. And so this talk is about a reuse of an old power plant. And another thing about Austin that's I'm very proud of, and it's true of many other cities as well, I have a lot to learn myself from other cities as well, is the three I's. One is innovative. Cities that are innovative and that promote innovation have a better chance of being sustainable in the decades or centuries that we have ahead. Also, independent. To be independent also means to be have standalone systems that can be more resilient in the case of adversity, be it a tsunami or a earthquake or a hurricane or a tidal, you know, anything that we might experience the last night or night before. And then lastly, the third I that I think is really important that we do a lot of in Austin, because we discuss and we cuss, but we have a lot of interaction. And interaction, I think, is very important because it allows the innovation and the independence to promote itself and to let people become more involved. And certainly all of us, I know I'm preaching to the choir, we talk about how much water we each use. We're looking for some avoidance of lifestyle change. But in reality, with interaction and talking about it, we don't have to change our real lifestyle, but we can make changes in our behavior that are much more sustainable. So with that, let me say that the Seaholm Power Plant is a case study. It's not as far along as most of the projects that you all are working on that you have finished. This is a proposal. The master development agreement is to be signed next week. It's about a $200 million project. And the feasibility of the rainwater system is about halfway there. So with that, let me give you some orientation. First, Austin, as you know, is in Texas, and it's in central Texas. The Colorado River, which is the Texas-Colorado River, flows through the center of Austin. And the Seaholm Power Plant, which was built in the late 40s, is right on Town Lake in downtown Austin. Downtown Austin is a fast-growing city. The metropolitan area is now about 1.3 million people, growing at about 4 or 5% per year. It became an independent electric operating city back in the two centuries ago. This was its first power plant. It provided 24 megawatts of power. And from that point on, Austin was independent of all other sources of energy and provided a municipal electric utility. Over the course of time, it grew and grew, and it needed to have its own much larger power plant to serve the entire city of 40 or 50,000 people. So the Seaholm plant was built, and it was built in phases. This power plant is, I can't remember the name of the engineering and architectural firm that designed it, but they did dozens and dozens across the United States. It was a kind of a modern or art deco style of building, and was designed to be very independent and versatile. It could run on coal or drawing a blank here, other sources of energy that it ran on, crude oil, and it could be operated in a variety of ways, but it was on the lake because it had to have a lot of cooling water. And so what we're going to be looking at is a power plant that has been decommissioned now for over 20 years, and with, as you can imagine, the attendant brownfield issues of cadmium, zinc, lead, PCBs, and on and on. $15 million later, it was remediated just a couple of years ago, and it is now available for some kind of reuse. In the reuse process, it was difficult to find all the information. Myself not being an engineer, this was not my task, but to piece together what could be used again if this power plant were to be used for something really innovative. It for 30 years now has been talked about as a possible museum site, a possible entertainment venue, something that the city could continue to own and operate. But in the year 2000, a master plan was developed for the Sehome District to say what could be the range of issues or opportunities for its reuse. And in so doing, the idea of a mixed-use development project was proposed that would really tie together some parts of downtown Austin in a way that were not tied together now because of the infrastructure in the area, substations, water plants, and this old power plant. And a competition was then held to see what firm nationwide or team could come up with the best mixed-use development project. There would be a public-private partnership with the City of Austin. And the Sehome Power Limited team, my two co-authors on the paper, John Rosato is the principal of Sehome Power Limited. He's actually a former student of mine, too. And Adam Roy is a current student who also is working for Sehome Power now, are very involved in this project. As you can see, there's much more to it than just the old power plant. There's a high-rise hotel condominium proposed and an office building, plus above ground and underground parking as well. And a very large plaza that doesn't really show up well on this venue, but a 3/4 acre of a public plaza for all kinds of entertainment venues. After all, Austin is claimed by some to be the music capital of the world. The space of the Turbin Hall, the main building, is on the order of about 125,000 square feet. And once fully renovated and converted to a mixed-use development, it will be a very exciting mixed-use office, retail, entertainment venue. So looking at the site, and I'm going to orient in different ways at different times, but this shows a north orientation to the drawing. You can see the Turbin building and where the hotel condominium and the new office building will be. And you also see a water intake pump house building on the lake, which would pump the water up from the lake and would flow into the turbine building to cool the turbines, 5 different turbines over the expansion of the system. So what I'm going to show you now is the proposed rainwater system for the Sehome Power District. And the exciting part of it is to adaptively reuse not only the building, but the energy infrastructure of the turbine cooling system for water conveyance, water storage, and final discharge and treatment. So you can see back and forth the orientation. So as I go through, I hope it won't be too confusing if I show you different pictures that are more CAD drawings. And you can see the amount of landscape. This will be a non-potable, primarily irrigation-oriented use of water. It's faster, cheaper, easier to get permitted and to reuse the water. And there will be a significant amount of water required for irrigation on such an intensively used landscape. A pre-feasibility, kind of a fatal flaw study was done to determine how much storage would be needed, the conveyance, the engineering and design costs and permitting and so forth. And it was roughly determined that it's going to take a long time to pay for this project. This is the bane of existence, isn't it, for people that can't pay for large-scale infrastructure up front. In the development of a negotiated public-private partnership, the master development agreement with the City of Austin includes $20 or $21 million of cash contribution from the city to Sehome Power Limited. After all, this will be a long-term lease. It'll ultimately revert back to the City of Austin. So if the developer puts in $160 or $180 million, what are the elements of this project that are worthy of public investment? And so the argument was made successfully that really helping to underwrite the reuse and the rainwater collection system would be an important part of that. So by picking a scenario which includes minimal, perhaps some demonstration scale toilet flushing, but otherwise all outdoor irrigation use, still a 22-year payback period was considered acceptable given the public investment in the project. So let me explain how the system works. On the north is to the right. and the lake is to the left. So the intake building has some low head pumps and lifts the water, say, 30 feet in, above the lake level and into a series of the red water intake pipes. They flow by very gentle gravity all the way to the right to the turbine building. And these are 42-inch pipes take water in to cool the turbines. The turbine steam process is a closed system with deionized water, totally separate system. This is just for cooling purposes. But very large volumes of water are brought in through large pipes to each turbine. And then as that water was heated, some of it to steam temperatures, it was then discharged through the blue lines, the condenser discharge pipes, out of the building at grade. No slope to those lines. And it was designed to flow out, given the dynamic change of steam pressure and water flow, to move out at a predicted rate, depending on how fast the turbines were turning, and to enter these cooling weir boxes. These were required, even back in the late 40s, they were designed because they knew that if they put the water back into the lake at 20 or 30 degrees above ambient water temperature, it's going to kill all the fish in the lake. And so these boxes were cooling tanks, if you will, to then finally release the water through the discharge pipes, 60-inch diameter pipes, off to Shoal Creek, which is just off the diagram. So these are the components of the condenser cooling system that had the potential for adaptive reuse for rainwater storage and conveyance. The discharge pipes, 42-inch pipes, one for each of the turbines. The big one on the left was the large turbine that was built in the last phase in the late 50s. This shows the discharge pipes entering the cooling weir box, one of the weir boxes. It's really exciting, this industrial large-scale systems. Exciting to me. The rooftop of the turbine building, which is about 45,000 square feet, has six downspouts. All of that drains through these downspouts internal to the building, because the building is not a rainproof building. It was heavy engineering, a lot of noise, and all the windows would open. And as such, there's a sump in the bottom of the building which collected the rainwater. And then it flowed through a series of 24-inch stormwater pipes into those same cooling weirs to get rid of the water, slowly but surely. So those exist too, six downspouts from the rooftop. The cooling weirs themselves, I find very interesting. They were not known to exist, except there was one guy named Harry who retired 6 months ago, who remembered that they were there and showed what they were on these one set of original drawings. And I was able to hear that from him and got so excited. And it's kind of why I got involved in the project, because this kind of underground infrastructure to build today would be just ominous. These are two good-looking young men in the pictures. But the East Weir, which is the smaller weir, has 49,000 gallons capacity. The other one's about 55,000 gallons capacity. They're underground, right in the front yard, ideally situated to receive the rainwater from the buildings, as you can see where they are here. And they have discharge pipes, which are 60 inches in diameter, almost at grade for 100, 150 feet off to the right, to the east, and then they fall slowly into Shoal Creek. So this pipe network, if you can imagine, because it's dead storage and it's fairly ambient, rising and falling with the water that would enter the cooling weirs, provides for a significant amount of overall storage. Harry, my new friend, became very mad at me. He didn't know me very well, but he yelled at me, cussed at me, threatened me, and said, if you ever go down in that weir box again, without a full suit, without full OSHA inspection, which is going to cost you at least $20,000. And I apologize, but we know what's there, and the feasibility of it is a little bit further along. In any case, the storage capacity, to be conservative, which is well over 200,000 gallons, we estimate that we can use 173,000 gallons of in-the-ground, heavy-duty storage for the rainwater system. The turbine building, as an example, has about 45,000 square feet, and the other buildings will be considered as well. The catchment areas, not only the turbine hall, but the office and parking, which was in the upper left, is about 28,000 square feet. The high-rise hotel condominium will probably have a green roof and not be used for rainwater collection, because it's further away and it will probably be under separate ownership ultimately. So we're looking at about 73,000 square feet of rooftop catchment area, plus the hardscape of the plaza, which from a stormwater management point of view and water quality point of view, we have extensive and very restrictive regulations in Austin. We're probably in the top three cities in the country in terms of water quality, storm runoff, guidance criteria, have to be handled very carefully. I'll mention that briefly at the end. But a simple spreadsheet yield analysis was developed to see how much we could capture. And based on an estimated demand by the landscape architects for the team of about 1.3 million gallons per year, and a certain estimated efficiency from the roofs, with municipal water supplementation, we can get 69% of the overall outdoor irrigation demand satisfied. And of course, that's not all of it. 100% in about 8 of the months, and maybe 40 or 50% in the summer months. As that system fills up, there always has to be an overflow system of some sort. Certainly, we have heavy and torrential rains in the Austin area. We heard about a 10-inch rain that was expected here. We had 16 inches in 4 hours just a month ago in the Austin area. So all systems have to be designed for that kind of extreme. So our scheme is to take the lower end of the discharge pipes and run a standpipe up of a substantial size so that as the water level gets to the point of overflow, it would rise out there and enter into a bioswale or some kind of stormwater detention, filtration, sedimentation device that would release the water fully cleaned and also become a landscape amenity, because actually the main entry to the Sehom project is going to be on the lower right side. So this would be a rain garden as well as an overflow area for the system. Some kind of a bioretention facility, and it's not really the focus of this talk, but that's just an off-the-shelf description. The storm runoff in Austin is such that in urban areas, the impervious cover has to be calculated, and the net additional impervious cover, depending on what percent there is, has to be captured in terms of the first flush runoff. So in this case, for this project, about 1.2 inches of the first flush of rainfall runoff has to be captured. Sedimentation, filtration, and performance measures of water quality beneficiation achieved. Altogether, about 37,000 gallons of retention, sedimentation, filtration, storage would be needed. And to the degree to which this storage system could be segmented to have a separate cell for stormwater, separate from the rooftop rainwater, we'll endeavor to do that. There might be another vault built at the eastern end of those discharge pipes that would be used to capture stormwater that could then be used for irrigation if need be, but would be kept separate for purposes of that rain garden and water quality improvement. So, in summary, this kind of a project is exciting to me, not only from the point of view of testing sustainability. The architectural team on the project is striving for platinum LEED certification. That's silver, gold, platinum. That's the highest level, which is a real challenge for an old building to do that. The rainwater system won't count for much. Tim, you were mentioning yesterday how little in the LEED certification process rainwater counts, which is a very unfortunate thing. But nonetheless, it's interesting, isn't it, how often water and power infrastructure can actually be, from a systems point of view, if solved simultaneously, achieving great benefits for communities. And certainly this is that kind of a case, I think. The last part I mentioned of the interaction of the independent and innovative interaction, I think is important for infrastructure, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but for waterworks engineers and planners and economists and so forth. All of that business was so invisible in years past and is becoming so much more transparent and evident. And rainwater systems is the classic physical manifestation of what we must use, and to see it is important. And so we're looking at all kinds of little design nuances, such as the sprinkler heads within the various gardens on the plaza might be designed in such a way as to actually create an artesian bubbling type of a diffusion of water from the rainwater system so that people can see the rainwater being used as it irrigates the rain gardens. And similarly, the downspouts would perhaps be replaced. They're very old, and they might be replaced with some kind of a Lexan or Lucite transparent pipes. So you can see when it rains, the water coming through the building into the sump area and then out to be used again. Thank you very much.